From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and it is a first for a sitting U.S. president, a visit to Kenya. That's where President Obama is today on his first trip as president to the country where his father was born. This weekend, he'll fly to Ethiopia, another African country that has never hosted a sitting U.S. president. The White House says the trip is an opportunity to promote trade and investment with Africa, but also to check in on countries that are fighting Islamic extremism. The BBC's Anne Soy joins us from Nairobi, Kenya. And Anne, first of all, what does President Obama's visit mean to Kenyans? You yourself are a Kenyan.
Indeed, it means a lot. The newspapers today, the television stations, most of them have been live. They're talking about Obama's visit. And many of them are calling it the Obama homecoming because they see Obama as one of them. One of the papers says, "Welcome back, son." You know, they see Obama as part of the Kenyan society, and so they are very excited about this. There is an air of anticipation. And the government yesterday, the Kenyan government, said that they were not going to declare Friday a public holiday because of the disruptions that were anticipated as a result of President Obama's arrival. But even so, the traffic today in Nairobi was uncharacteristically clear. I think people just decided to stay away from work and just to wait for this grand arrival.
Before he left Washington, President Obama gave an interview to the BBC, and he was asked about, among other things, gay rights in Africa. Here's part of what he said.
I am not a fan of discrimination and bullying of anybody on the basis of race, on the basis of religion, on the basis of sexual orientation or gender. And I think that this is actually part and parcel of the agenda that's also going to be front and center, and that is, how are we treating women and girls?
And he went on to say that he has family in Kenya and he knows the history of the country's history of how they treat women and girls. How are those comments being received in Kenya?
Well, there has been discussion for weeks, even before this visit, especially after the United States passed the law on gay marriage. And this is a sensitive topic here in Kenya. It is a sensitive topic in the African context. But when you look at the country, compared to neighbors such as Uganda, compared, for instance, to Nigeria, the gay community has had some room to sort of feel free, even though they do not feel as free as they would be in the West, for instance. And this is an ongoing discussion. Some of the politicians have had very strong comments about and very strong positions about the gay issue. For instance, the deputy president, calling it, very, very strong names and saying that the Kenyan society opposes it. The discussion is on. It is not the entire society that is against the gay community here. There is a considerable portion of the Kenyan population that considers themselves liberal, and just like many other places, it is normally a hot discussion here.
Is there also some sensitivity regarding President Obama's meeting with Kenya's leaders? The deputy president, William Ruto, is under indictment by the International Criminal Court for alleged links to violence in Kenya after the 2007 election. Is that going to be a delicate topic during this visit?
It is something that has come up time and again, and the president, President Kenyatta, was asked this question, whether his deputy was going to meet with President Obama, and he said that President Obama is going to meet the entire government, part of which is the deputy president of Kenya. And in the Kenyan context, they do not see it as a big controversy. However, rights groups, for instance, are particularly concerned about the message that such a meeting is going to send.
That's the BBC's Anne Soy speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya, where President Obama is today. Anne, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a deeper look now at the security situation in Kenya. There have been major deadly terrorist attacks there in recent years. So how might the president's visit affect that? Dr. J. Peter Pham is the director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and he joins us. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
So in reporting on the president's trip, several media outlets have referred to security concerns in Kenya. CNN referred to Kenya yesterday as a hotbed of terror, and that drew some criticism in response on Twitter. But I'm just wondering, how would you characterize the security situation in Kenya these days?
Well, the security situation in Kenya, in fact, throughout the Horn of Africa, things are stable and they're improving. There's still a considerable security challenge because of the instability, more than two decades of Somalia being a utterly failed state, Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked militant terrorist group operating out of Somalia. It's lost a lot of territory. It's been rolled back by the African Union forces operating there, but it still poses a terror threat to the region. On the other hand, I think we have to be put this all in perspective and say that despite some horrific attacks, including the one Kenya suffered earlier this year at Garissa University College, the region certainly has improved markedly in security, thanks in large part to the international community and the U.S. in particular, the contribution to building up local African military capacity, especially as part of the African Union force.
Right. Well, you mentioned Garissa University. I mean, more than 140 people were killed in that attack. I mean, and that has to be on the minds of Kenyans and, of course, the president's security team as well. Anywhere President Obama's going to go, there will be high levels of security. We know that. But I'm wondering, on this particular trip to Kenya, is the concern then that Al-Shabaab might attack a soft target, sort of the periphery of the president's visit, and perhaps put more Kenyans in danger?
Well, certainly those concerns are realistic and should be kept in focus. But I think the real concern that I and many others have is that this monomaniacal emphasis on security overshadows the larger agenda of the president's strategic engagement in Kenya as well as Ethiopia and the first ever visit to the African Union by a sitting U.S. president. So there are larger dimensions of this trip that are unfortunately perhaps being lost in the shuffle.
We won't let them get lost too much in this conversation, but at the risk of a little more monomania, let me just ask you, I mean, I do want to know whether you think that is there any connection or any relationship that has emerged between, say, Al-Shabaab and ISIS or other terrorist groups? Or is Al-Shabaab still mostly a regional concern for the Horn of Africa?
Well, Al-Shabaab has always had links. They've had longstanding links with what is now Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, AQAP. And Al-Shabaab itself swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda in 2012, and that allegiance was accepted. They're a formal affiliate of Al-Qaeda, as announced by Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's successor. So these links have been there for a long time. But the ability to operate on those links beyond the immediate neighborhood of Somalia and its neighbors, that's a different issue.
Mm. Well, let's talk about then what you were just saying a little bit earlier, that this is the first time an American president has visited the African Union. I mean, President Obama is going to go to the Global Entrepreneurship Summit there in Kenya. He's also going to meet Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta. So what should Kenya expect from Obama's visit there?
Well, I think it's an intensely emotional moment, not only for the president, who's spoken movingly about his own links to Kenya, but also for the Kenyan people, many of whom were extremely excited at the time of his election more than 6 years ago. But also for Kenya, it highlights this trip and the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, the first time that gathering has ever been held in a sub-Saharan African country, highlights the growing dynamism of Africa in general, the economic opportunities there, but in particular of Kenya and its neighbors in the East Africa community, which is one of Africa's fastest integrating regional groups, a group of states that have worked very hard in recent years to lower barriers to trade and commerce in order to build a common market large enough to attract significant foreign direct investment and trade.
Mm. And finally, Dr. Pham, I wonder, how would you rate President Obama's legacy in terms of what he's done in for vis-a-vis Africa?
Well, so far in this administration, I don't think we have the type of legacy legislative piece which was passed in the Clinton administration. And, of course, President Bush, with his engagements on humanitarian issues, especially the president's emergency program for AIDS relief, his work on malaria. But we do have a building on of that legacy of his two predecessors. American policy to Africa is much more invigorated today. The U.S. looks at Africa less as a challenge, but more as an opportunity, the engagement on economic issues. So in that respect, although there may not be a signature piece, I think in the tradition of Africa policy, really, for the last several decades, it's been a bipartisan exercise. And the president, just before he left for Kenya, signed the renewal of the AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act legislation, for another 10 years. And that passed by overwhelming majorities in both houses, even in our divided government in Washington.
Well, Dr. J. Peter Pham is director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
It's been a big week for the 2016 presidential race. Ohio Governor John Kasich joined the crowded Republican field, a field getting extra crowded by one personality in particular, Donald Trump, who has been stealing the headlines and leading the polls.
As for the Democrats, Hillary Clinton's campaign had to deal with the announcement today that two inspector generals have asked the Justice Department to open an inquiry into those emails from the personal account she used as Secretary of State. So with that and so very much more, we turn to our weekly discussion on the race for 2016.
Here and now,
2016.
And joining us from Washington, Jesse Holland, race, ethnicity, and demographics writer on the Associated Press Politics team. Jesse, welcome back.
Thank you.
And from Des Moines, Iowa, somebody who knows that theme song very well at this point, O.K. Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. Kay, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks for inviting me back.
And let's start with the news coming out today of this possible investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails. Is this another – and we should say, by the way, that the Clinton campaign is saying that any emails that were deemed classified by the administration were released after the fact and not they weren't classified at the time that they were transmitted. But is this a tick in the story? Is this real trouble for the Clinton campaign?
Well, right now, it seems like just another tick in the story for Hillary Clinton. It seems like every couple of weeks, something from the past comes back to haunt her. But she just keeps right on going. And until she gets a serious, credible competition on the Democratic side, all of these stories seem to just blow over her campaign. Because right now, there doesn't seem to be too many people who are going to be able to challenge her for the nomination.
Kay, do you agree with that?
Yes, and that was evident this past Friday when she was sharing a stage with four of her competitors for the Democratic nomination, and not one took on this particular issue during their remarks or even hinted at criticism of her other than a vague reference by Jim Webb to her vote for the Iraq War.
Does any of this matter to voters? I mean, because when she's on the campaign trail, it seems like she's talking about everything else other than this issue around her time as Secretary of State. I mean, does it matter to voters, Kay?
Until there's some sort of smoking gun found among these emails, I don't think it matters to Democratic voters. This is right now about securing the Democratic nomination. I think this thing will come back in the general election if she is the nominee, and it will be talked about by whomever Republicans field as her challenger.
What about on the Republican side? I think let's just get it out of the way right now and talk about Donald Trump.
We'll get to
John Kasich in a second, but let's talk about Trump because he has been getting a lot of attention here. And in Laredo, Texas yesterday, he was down at the border and he was asked by a reporter for Telemundo about his earlier comments about Mexican immigrants being rapists and criminals. Here's what he said.
That's a typical case of the press with misinterpretation. They take a half a sentence. They take a half a sentence. By the way, they take a half a sentence, then they take a quarter of a sentence. They put it all together. It's a typical thing. And you're with Telemundo, and Telemundo should be ashamed. And I'll tell you something, what's really going to be fun? I'm right now suing Univision for $500 million, and I want to tell you, we're going to win a lot of money because of what they do.
So Jesse, your thoughts?
Well, he certainly knows how to speak to his crowd. One of the biggest problems that the Republican primary has right now is that everyone's competing to compete in the first debate. And whoever has the most attention gets on that stage, that the top 10 candidates get on that stage. So Donald Trump has figured out how to make sure he's on that stage. He's saying inflammatory things. He's saying what some Republicans say that people are thinking but not saying. He's just saying it, and it's bringing him attention and will vault him into the debate coming up on August 6th. Right.
In which he will maybe face a lot of other fellow Republicans who are not his friends. I mean, Trump has been calling Rick Perry, quote, stupid. He called Lindsey Graham an idiot. And he refused to apologize for criticizing Senator John McCain's war record. He's even sort of teased people about running a third-party candidacy. And, of course, the GOP is hitting back. Here's Rick Perry speaking in Washington on Wednesday.
Let no one be mistaken. Donald Trump's candidacy is a cancer on conservatism, and it must be clearly diagnosed, excised, and discarded.
So, Kate, really, what is this doing to the GOP right now?
Well, he is a conduit for the frustration that Republicans have felt for the past 7 years because there's a Democrat in the White House. He's touching on some real issues. Everyone talks about income inequality among the Democrats being a key issue. It's among Republicans, too, but in a different way. They're upset about the trade deals that Congress has approved. And he's really sort of like, I liken it to, has everyone seen broadcast news? Remember when Albert Brooks was sitting on the couch and he said, I see it here, and then it comes out my television screen with the anchor saying it there? I think that's what really appeals to voters about Donald Trump. They think it, and then they hear him see it.
Okay, well, this is the next thing I'm about to say is going to appeal to a lot of people who've been writing in and saying, stop talking about Donald Trump. Let's talk about John Kasich, who announced this week that he is running as well. Here he is.
I have the experience and the testing. The testing which shapes you and prepares you for the most important job in the world. And I believe I know how to work and help restore this great United States. And I have to tell you, it's a daunting challenge.
This is a governor of Ohio who has been reelected overwhelmingly in a very important state. How does he distinguish himself? How does he stand out in this crowded field?
And that's the problem that he's going to have. Right now, there are so many Republicans running for this nomination, and Donald Trump, sorry, I had to say it, is sucking up so much air, it's hard for any other candidate to distinguish himself. His big problem right now is he's getting in so late. Will he have a chance to even get into the first debate? And how do you outshine Chris Christie? How do you outshine Jeb Bush? These are all governors who can boast the same gubernatorial experience that John Kasich is going to try to tout. He has a chance, but he's going to have to find some way to make himself stand out over everyone else in this very crowded field.
Well, Kay, could sort of the pragmatic Midwestern governor image that Kasich have work, especially in the primaries, where more conservative agendas tend to be what takes center stage?
Well, you also got Scott Walker, by the way.
Well,
another
Midwestern governor. We already have a Midwestern governor who's really caught fire here. Polls show Walker is leading in Iowa. There was a poll this past week by Quinnipiac University which showed that 82% of the Iowa voters they surveyed didn't know enough about John Kasich to even have an opinion about him. So he starts really at ground zero, competing not only against Scott Walker, but Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana, the former governor of Texas, Rick Perry. Republicans love a chief executive, someone who's been a governor. His problem is he's competing against so many of them, and his resume looks a lot like Scott Walker's.
I want to go back to the Democratic side while we've got you here, Jesse. And there was an event over the weekend. Senator Bernie Sanders and the former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, were heckled at the Netroots Nation conference. Let's listen. Here's O'Malley.
Black lives matter. White lives matter. All lives matter. Black lives matter. White lives matter. All lives matter.
Clearly, in that crowd, that was the wrong response. But explain and tell us how you think both he and Sanders handled that situation.
Well, what happened with the Netroots Nation conference is that a group of protesters from the Black Lives Matter campaign disrupted the conference, and they both, Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley, tried to respond. As we heard from Martin O'Malley's response, his response was, well, all lives matter.
Right.
But that sort, for the protesters, that sort of downplays their complaints of treatment of African Americans by police, as we've seen this week in the Texas case with the Sandra Bland case. So Bernie Sanders refused to deal with this at all on stage. After he got his response from the crowd, Martin O'Malley actually went out and talked to the protesters and tried to come to some agreement with them. Bernie Sanders moved on. So we're going to see this, I think, come up over and over in the Democratic nomination. There are a lot of young African-American voters who want to hear these candidates address these issues. And so far, they haven't. So that's why we're seeing these protests pop up.
Right. Kay, your quick thoughts on that?
It's interesting to see Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders on the stump here in Iowa. Sanders answers by far more questions from the audience than any other candidate.
Well, it's going to be really interesting to see how Democrats post-Obama manage to appeal to African-American voters as well. But that's the time we have this week for our 2016 roundup. Jesse Holland with the AP Politics team in Washington, thanks to you. And O.K. Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa in Des Moines, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It is, of course, the end of the week, so let's check in on how the news played out on social media. With us to talk about this week's trending topics is Mike Berry, Deputy Audience Director for The Guardian US. And Mike, let's just start with the ongoing conversation on social media regarding Sandra Bland. And of course, she's the woman who was found dead in a Waller County, Texas prison. Last week, the hashtag What Happened to Sandra Bland began trending. This week, I'm seeing the rise of some conspiracy theories on social media regarding the Sandra Bland case. What are you seeing?
Yes, it's certainly understandable to characterize them as conspiracy theories, but I think it's part of a larger, wider sort of citizen journalism that is taking place around these deaths in custody of people of color. The reason why I say citizen journalism is that since this story broke, what happened to Sandra Bland has been a hashtag that leads to a lot of discussions about the video that was possibly edited, although it was re-uploaded and it seemed to suddenly sink, disparities in the arrest records, questions that people are asking about Sandra Bland's mugshot and whether she was, it's hard to say this, was dead in her mugshot. These are conspiracy theories to some people, and to other people, this is a larger community of activists trying to hold the news media and officials as well to account for certain disparities that they're seeing in what is being said in public and what seems to have happened behind closed doors.
Mm. So a lot of activity and citizen journalism, as you're saying, going on social media, even with these stories, or maybe especially with these stories that get a lot of mainstream media attention. While I've got you, Mike, if we can talk just for a second about maybe sort of the biggest blow up that happened on Twitter recently, and that's between Nicki Minaj and Taylor Swift over the Video Music Awards.
Yes, this is sort of the lighter side of these larger discussions of race in America. But when Nicki Minaj tweeted out her disappointment that her Anaconda video wasn't nominated for an MTV Video Music Award, Taylor Swift inserted herself into the discussion. And it was a very strange back and forth. It involved Taylor Swift essentially taking offense at something Nicki Minaj had said about slim bodies being portrayed in music videos. Nicki Minaj pointed out that she never said anything at all about Taylor Swift, and she was making a larger point about how black culture, black music can be reappropriated, even as these black artists are not being rewarded for coming up with these creative concepts. So it really led to an interesting intersection of celebrity politics and sort of two giant fan bases going at each other, while also speaking to, again, this very large debate that we're having on many different fronts about race in America.
Yeah. You know what was interesting about it to me is that Nicki Minaj brought up some really good points, I thought. And whether or not one thinks Taylor Swift's responses were tone deaf or not, it made me wonder whether or not Twitter, even to this day, is a good place for nuanced conversations about race and music.
Well, I think the difficult thing is cutting out the clutter. There were real important discussions. And I think that that's an example of how social media can lead mainstream media's think pieces, discussions, you know, longer-term coverage of these issues. It may seem messy in the moment to experience this sort of back and forth, which might be vitriolic, which might have sort of weird overtones to it. But at the same time, it leads to the news media starting to take a more critical look at the issues that Nicki Minaj was actually bringing up. And if the attention can be drawn through this sort of messy world of social media to these bigger issues, I think that it certainly informs and enriches the news coverage.
Well, Mike Berry is the Deputy Audience Director for The Guardian U.S., great to talk to you, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ sessions. There goes the last DJ. And we're going bluegrass today with Kenny Rohrer, a longtime host of Back to the Blue Ridge on WVTF Public Radio in Roanoke, Virginia. Kenny, welcome back.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I'm glad y'all invited me back.
Well,
I appreciate it.
It is great to have you back and have some bluegrass music as we get deep into the summer here and some new artists performing. And let's start with this musician, Kitty Amaral. And here is the song Tennessee Mountain Fox Chase. And that's Kitty playing the fiddle there.
It certainly is. And that young lady is 12 years old, believe
wow.
it or not.
Wow.
She's a regular listener to our show, superb fiddler. And one of the things I try to do on the show about every week is play something by some of the younger artists, in addition, of course, the established bands, but young folks who've gotten interested in bluegrass and old-time music. And she is a superb young old-time fiddler. 12 years old, been listening to our show since she was 8.
And she's been playing the violin since she was 4, we read.
Absolutely, yeah. And that Tennessee Mountain Fox Chase that she's doing is fabulous because you hear her imitate with the fiddle the sounds of the yelping fox hounds on the trail of the fox. What a great job she does with that.
Are a lot of young people getting into bluegrass at this point in 2015?
I'm seeing more and more young folks getting into bluegrass and old-time music. You know, we're this area of Virginia and West Virginia and the Piedmont of North Carolina, Virginia, is kind of to bluegrass and old-time music what New Orleans is to jazz and what Chicago is to blues. We probably have more banjo pickers and fiddlers per square foot than about any part of the country. If we're going to keep this music going, then we've got to get young people involved.
Absolutely. Well, and there's a young fiddler. Let's get to a young banjo picker. This is Corbin Haislett. Here is Darling Cora.
Well, the first time I saw Darling Cory, she's a sitting on the deep blue sea. With a 40-40 around her and a banjo on her knee. And the last time I saw Darling Cory had a wine glass in her hand. She's drinking down her trouble with a low-down sorry man.
Now, how old is Corbin Haislett? Not 12.
He's either 20 or 21. I think maybe 20. He has been on our show as a guest when he was probably 14 or 15 years old. Fabulous young banjo player, and he won a contest to get to play on that particular CD called Orthophonic Joy. And boy, what a powerhouse clawhammer banjo player he is, and fine singer as well, too, one of the best, and can play all kinds of styles of banjo as well. And he's the kind of musician that gives you hope for this music. That it's going to be people like Corbin and Kitty and Daniel Greason and others who keep this music going for us down the road.
Well, let's get to another one that you wanted us to hear. This is the fiddle player Daniel Greason, and here is the song Roanoke.
¶¶
That is some fast finger work.
I'll tell you, and that young man knows how to play a fiddle. He's a high school student, believe it or not, in Guilford County, North Carolina, in the Piedmont, North Carolina, Greensboro. And boy, does he know how to pull a bow. And he's one of those people that could play Fire on the Mountain and you could smell the leaves burning, you know, that kind of talent that he has. And that tune, of course, was written here in Roanoke, Virginia, as a tribute to Roanoke, written by the father of bluegrass himself, Bill Monroe. And here it is in the hands of a young man. I think he was 15 when he made that record. And boy, does he know how to fiddle.
Is the new bluegrass music that you're hearing really inspired by the old bluegrass music, or are these young artists trying to do something different?
Well, yes and no. Some of them are trying to do something different, but some of them go back to the roots of the music, and that's what has inspired them, what got them going. I think Daniel Greason plays it pretty straight, much in the Kenny Baker tradition, who, of course, was fiddler with Bill Monroe for 28 years. And Daniel Greason is following the tradition. He's very much in the traditional style of that music.
Well, we have time for one more, and this is from a more established group. This is Big Country Bluegrass, and here is the Cotton Mill Song.
While living at home when I was just a child, every day my heart was filled with joy. No cares did I feel. Mother called us in from fields while Daddy worked there. Before we all were fed, Daddy thanked the Lord for bread he made from that old cotton mill.
And we hear there about Daddy going to work at the cotton mill and coming home. Is work the topic of a lot of bluegrass music, or what are they singing about mostly?
Well, it work very often. Of course, there's dance music, love songs, event ballads. But work songs, whether it's working in the coal mines or working in the cotton mills, reflect the local culture and the lives of the people here. And that song was written by a guy named Jerry Jones, whose family worked in the Dan River Mills in Danville, Virginia. And, you know, we're a part of what used to be the Cotton Belt. It sounds like a yarn, but it stretched all the way from Lynchburg, Virginia, down into central Alabama and employed thousands of people in the 1920s. Well, in Danville, Virginia, 1950, we had 12,000 people who worked in Dan River Mills that you hear Big Country Bluegrass singing about. And now those mills are closed, completely gone, and many of them have been torn down. So it's a time that does not exist anymore and will not exist anymore, I suspect. But it celebrates the employment that the mills gave the people here in the Piedmont.
But you're not hearing a lot of bluegrass songs about working in the Apple store or, you know, anything like that.
No, and I doubt we're going to. I don't think that's going to happen. Maybe it will somewhere down the road, but I don't see it anytime soon. You're absolutely right, Jeremy.
Well, Kenny, as you travel around the country, do you find that people all over the place have a love of bluegrass music, or is it really nowhere is it loved more than where you are in Southwest Virginia?
Well, we're the fertile crescent of bluegrass and old-time music. I mean, we're in the heartland of it, but you find it everywhere. I mean, one of the great bluegrass groups around today is from upstate New York, the Gibson Brothers. You have the Spinney Brothers from Nova Scotia in Canada, that great bluegrass band. I remember being on a subway in Prague, the Czech Republic, several years ago with some of my students, and there was a guy carrying a guitar case there. And, of course, I don't speak Czech, and he did not speak English especially well. But I walked over to the guy when I saw a guitar case, and I said, "You play guitar?" And he said, "Yes, dobro, bluegrass music." I thought, wow. There you go. It's
all
everywhere.
All the way to the
it's
Czech
everywhere.
Republic.
Yeah.
Kenny Rohrer, longtime host of Back to the Blue Ridge on WVTF Public Radio in Roanoke, Virginia. You can check out their Facebook page at facebook.com/backtotheblueridge. Kenny, thank you so much.
Thank you. We do appreciate it.
And if you're just joining us, you are not listening to Car Talk. This is Here and Now, but we're listening here to Grigsby's Hornpipe, performed by Seth Swingle. You can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org. There are a lot of headlines today from the business world. So let's bring in Mike Regan of Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. And let's first get to this big merger between two of the biggest health insurers in the U.S. This has been speculated about, but we now know Anthem has agreed to buy rival Cigna in a deal valued in the tens of billions of dollars. What's behind this?
Well, there's a big wave of consolidation going on in the health insurance industry, a total of about $90 billion worth of deals so far. And most of the time, what is cited as the reason is President Obama's health care overhaul really put a lot of restrictions on insurance companies, making it harder for them to turn as big of a profit as they had in the past. So the idea is that if they companies combine, they'll be able to cut costs and keep their profit margins up in the face of these restrictions on them from Obamacare.
But when I think of companies combining and consolidation, the first thing I think of is the airline industry and all the consolidation we've seen there. And what that has meant, in part, is higher prices. So what does this mean for consumers?
Well, that is exactly the concern about all these mergers in the health insurance industry. And it's possible that some of them may even get blocked by the government on antitrust concerns. Obviously, health insurance is something that we all have to buy, and the prices have been going up pretty dramatically even without all these mergers. So the head of the Justice Department's antitrust division has said he's going to look at the industry as a whole, you know, to make sure competition is preserved and to make sure that the mergers don't lead to higher costs. So it is a very real possibility that some of these mergers will be blocked.
So a big merger announcement in the health insurance industry, and another big story in the world of business from Amazon, which announced something very unusual yesterday. It actually made a profit. Why is that a surprise, Mike?
Right. Well, Amazon has grown its sales, its revenue number tremendously. It's estimated to be over $104 billion in sales this year. But instead of booking big profits, Jeff Bezos' strategy has basically been to reinvest those profits into the business. So, you know, they're doing things like cloud computing and web services. And investors have, you know, have been pretty much, you know, rewarding them for those plans, even though they're not turning a profit. So this quarter, you know, their sales were up 20% to more than $23 billion for the quarter, and their expenses just didn't rise as much. So it's a sign that, you know, they can be incredibly profitable once they decide to stop investing back in the business. And, you know, investors are taking this as a sign of that potential.
And we see that their market capitalization is now bigger than Walmart's. Pretty amazing.
It is. It is. You know, and it's obviously a trend of retail getting into this sort of, you know, mega store concept like Walmart and Amazon is online. So in a way, it's good for consumers as far as lowering prices. But, you know, it obviously is sort of bad for your Main Street economy, your mom and pop retail stores. So it's a dual-edged sword.
Well, while Amazon was having a blockbuster quarter, a company that is not nearly the same household name was moving in the other direction. Anglo American, a big mining company, is slashing tens of thousands of jobs. What's going on there?
Commodity prices, you know, including the metals that Anglo mines and even diamonds that they mine, they've just been suffering across the board. Anglo American's earnings sank about 30%. To $904 million, and they're really just a victim of this rout in commodities that we've seen.
And why are we seeing a rout in commodities?
There's really sort of two things at play. One is that China is one of the biggest consumers of commodities, and they've had this blockbuster growth over the last decade. That growth is really slowing pretty dramatically to about under 6% this year from, you know, it was in the double digits not too long ago. So, you know, they're basically consuming fewer commodities than they not fewer, but the growth in their consumption of commodities in China is a lot less than it used to be. And the other thing really hurting commodities is the dollar. You know, all commodities everywhere are pretty much traded in the dollar. So the stronger it gets, that tends to weigh on the prices of commodities, because if you're producing commodities in you know, in a country with a weaker currency, you're not expecting as much, you know, as far as dollar price for that commodity.
Actually, I see that the huge mining company, the Swiss company Glencore Xstrata, its stock price is at the lowest level it's been ever since it went public. So this is affecting the whole industry.
It absolutely is. Yeah, it's a very big story.
One more thing. We heard from Apple this week. Now, they said that profits were up 38%, iPhone sales were up, and yet nobody was happy with that. Why?
Well, China, again, is a big story for Apple. You know, it's on track to be their biggest market. And iPhone sales year over year, so compared to last year's third quarter, were up very strongly, but they were down very significantly from the second quarter. And there's a big concern that this rout in the Chinese stock market will leave consumers there with less to spend on things like iPhones, and that the general slowdown in the economic growth there will have an impact on Apple.
So we're starting to see what is happening around the world as a result of what is going on in China. While we were all focusing so much on Greece, China's slowdown really is starting to ripple. Mike Regan of Bloomberg News, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Agnes Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.